Welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. My name is Erin Bowles. I'm an actor, writer, and huge enthusiast for 60 Degree Weather. Our guest today is Hua Chen. Hua Chen is a Brooklyn-based graphic designer who creates systems out of words and seeks to be as unserious as possible as often as possible. Hello!
Hello!
This is going to be so fun because we went to 6th through 10th grade together. You're the first guest that I grew up with in a childhood all about growing up. And our book today is John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, which we read together in 10th grade in Mr. Swift's class. And I was like a high academic achiever. English class was my zone. I did not remember anything from this book. I don't know where I was.
I know, like literally every single, like the last half of the book, I think half the things that happened, I was like, what? Like, when was this?
All I remembered was the final image of Rosa Sharn breastfeeding a man to save him from starvation. And that was it.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad you picked it. What a book. Like, truly, the back of my book says, like, this is the greatest American novel ever. And I can't fight it. It's the 85th anniversary of its publication. It is just as relevant and hard-hitting as ever. And what's crazy is we didn't just read it, like, at the same time. We were in the same classroom. I sat diagonal from you. I remember this.
Yeah.
We, like, ate lunch with our teacher. Hell yeah.
Yeah. What was it? Our little, like, table group.
Yeah. And I was also thinking, like, I don't think I ever had a teacher who was as universally beloved as Mr. Swift was.
No, that man was an angel. Do you remember when we had to, like, write? I think it was in his class where we, like, ended up, like, writing an essay, like, from the point of view of like one of the other characters. I think I did like Connie.
Oh, I don't remember that. I remembered having to do like chapter summaries, at least I think when we started reading the book, because something I loved about it then and still now is for most of the book, it alternates between really specific, longer narrative chapters about the Joad family. And the others are just really broad, like often like rooted in nature, about sort of unrelated characters that we don't know, you know, the everyman. And I didn't realize it then, but how different that is, how it plays with form, how it's not a strict narrative all the time. I mean, really an incredible book.
Yeah, I was literally thinking about that as I was like beginning the reread, because I was like, oh, it feels very much like, you know, some of the intercalary chapters, you can also see like where like some of the anonymous characters like are directly then referenced in like the next chapter when like you start like kind of diving more into like the main narrative. And it feels very much like in any kind of like script, I guess, like in the beginning where you have that sort of like scene setting chapter and then you have like entrance, which was it was really fun.
It was something really early on, like in film school, there's a book that you study like 8 times over called Save the Cat about structure. And are you familiar with this term, Save the Cat?
No, not at all.
Okay. It's the book that tells you how to like structure a script of like beginning, middle, end, and here's all the steps. And it's called Save the Cat because there's a strategy of like within the first 3 or so pages to have your audience endeared to your main character, have a moment, and they cite an example where it's like where the protagonist is like walking down the street and sees a cat stuck in a tree and saves it, and then we suddenly love it. And there is an anti-save the cat moment immediately in this book where they spend one of those, you know, out of narrative chapters about getting you to empathize with this poor turtle. And then Tom Joad picks it up and is just like, I don't give a shit, man. You're coming with me, which I loved.
Yeah. Okay. Also, like I had completely forgotten, like that was the first thing that I realized that I had completely forgotten about was the fucking turtle and how like the truck driver literally swerves to hit it. I was like the first 5 minutes of like rereading this book, I was like, I'm a little bit upset.
And then I think later Al swerves to hit some snakes and Tom's like, don't do that. And he's like, well, I hate him. So
he's thinking about that turtle.
He still is. So, I mean,
No.
we've talked about it, but the question I always ask is, what's your story with this book? How did it enter your life? And I also want to know, like, we went to different high schools after 10th grade. Did this come back? Did you have to read it again?
So yes. So I mean, this book was part one of many that I think we share in the long history of knowing each other. After I moved away after 10th grade, I signed up for AP Lang so that I could, like, from across the country still have the same curriculum as you guys, because I was deeply upset. But then I was upset in a different way when I walked into class and they were like, "We're gonna read Grapes of Wrath. None of you have ever read this." I was like, "I have." They were like, "Sucks."
It was, and it, I
And
mean, it sounds like that was the very first thing. So it, and we read it at the very end of 10th grade. So it would be like, this was 6 months ago. I just did this, right?
no, literally. So, like the fact that I actually can't remember half of the shit that happens is a little bit like my bad. I read, like, I think we, before Grapes of Wrath, had also read Of Mice and Men, I think the year before. Because I have a really clear memory of, like, reading that over, like, a break or something, and, like, being on a cruise when, like, the final scene hits, and I, like, and in the years since, I've read, like, a number of other Steinbeck books, because I was like, oh, like, usually I don't really like when authors, like, are so descriptive. I don't really love when there's, like, a lot of, I always use the example of Dickens, who I have a really hard time reading, but, like, I feel like Steinbeck has such, like, an economy of words where, like, all of his descriptions to me at least feel very, like, useful in painting the scenes, whereas, like, I think I just did not have that sort of empathy with, like, Dickens.
It's my copy is almost 600 pages, and I'm always editing. I'm always looking for things to cut, and it really, like, he doesn't waste time. And it's like, it's this great, like, I think, see how many episodes I mentioned Wizard of Oz in, because it's everywhere. It's everywhere. I was just watching it. But I think, like, one of the, when you're talking about, like, the stories of America, of, like, American lore and folk tales, the sort of, like, road trip is a really classic kind of format. Even if you, like, really want to stretch it, like, fucking Lewis and Clark is, you know, one of those founding sort of, like, mythological narratives. And it is a road trip. And I think that's, like, this turns it on its head. The promised land ends up being disappointing. I love the trope anytime setting up a story with a guy just got out of jail. It's very specific for me, but I love it.
And it's also, like, to kind of, like, set it up with, like, the main character immediately, like, arriving from jail, like, you for the first, like, chapter, so you don't know why he's been in there, like, whatever. And then, like, following him through the rest of the story, it kind of, like, sets you up to kind of, like, understand, or, like, at least foreshadow the role of the law in, like, the latter half of the book. It's also, like, interesting because I think the first time when we read it, like, I was in a very different place in, like, my critique of authority. And now reading it, I'm like, go off, go off. Like, every time
Ooh.
we talk about a cop, I'm like, hell yeah.
There is a line, I think, when they're in the government camp that's like, cops never bring any good with them. This came out in 1939. It won the National Book Award, Pulitzer Prize for fiction. It was extremely controversial. There was a lot of backlash to it, which completely makes sense. This is radical today. And that makes me really happy that it was taught in high schools. And I'm never gonna get over our 10th grade English teacher, because just before this, in my memory, we read Cry the Beloved Country about apartheid in
Yes.
South Africa. We started that year with Beloved by Toni Morrison, which, like, I don't even know if I would read that to high schoolers, because that is such a like a brutal book. And that's how we started the year, and it's an amazing book. Oh
Yeah.
man.
What did we read after Grapes of Wrath? Do you remember?
I feel like it was the end of the year, so I don't know.
It's kind of incredible too, because it was very in the vein of, like, like in freshman year when we read, like, Raisin in the Sun. And, like, then when we started having, like, media literacy classes, which is, like, something that I, like, I feel like I talk about a lot in my adult life. I'm like, why don't more people take these classes?
Absolutely.
Like,
Yeah. A thing I think about every day is, like, question your sources. Where is this information coming from? Such a critical thing. And I remember having that class in, like, the worst classroom in that building. bizarre little building.
It's interesting because I feel like it set all of us up to like understand that there are so many like different perspectives depending on who you are or what your context is, or like even like in this book, like how many generations you are removed from like conflict, the cycle of like people becoming like embroiled in the system and uncomfortable, and then kind of like creating in themselves like a fear or distrust of others that might jeopardize their
Absolutely.
position in the system.
Yeah. I mean, the subjects that it touches on are so broad. It talks about incarceration with Tom leaving jail. It talks about inequality. The Dust Bowl feels, I don't know the origins of the Dust Bowl, other than problems with farming and sort of farming the land to death. But that screams global warming to me. I know that's how I read it at the time. And I also, this is just something I was thinking about today. I like read the last 10 pages or so this morning, and it's like you start the book with all of this stuff about how cracked and dry the land is, and it ends in a flood. This tremendous, tremendous, like sheets of rain flood. Like I can't get over how good it is. I think I had this mentality of like, well, Steinbeck, like everyone has to read, and he's like important because he's important, and he deserves it. Now I see he really deserves it.
Like some of the things that like they talk about in the beginning, like when the Jodes are being driven out of their land, and they're talking about like the advent of like tractors and like how, you know, like technology is advancing and also like being like misused. And then like kind of like also like echoes today, like the more that we have like, you know, this stupid ass AI shit.
That's the thing. Like, I want to be so anti-AI because I am an actor and like my fa and a writer, and like that's my livelihood. But then I get on TikTok and I see like AI generated images of like little ducklings cooking noodles, and that's what it should be used for, I think. That's good. But also, there are artists to do that now. Just as I'm saying that, dear God.
No, I okay, so like when like ChatGPT or like not Midjourney is the one when it started, you know, like being able to generate images. I think like at least in graphic design, everybody was like, oh my God, this is it. This is the end. We've been able to hold out, but this is the end. But honestly, like and recently their OpenAI started doing like you can feed in text and they'll generate like videos, and it's absurd how realistic it is. Like independently, you can still tell like this work is like not quite real. Like it because like I think over the years, at least for designers, it's become a little bit more of just like a tool to like visualize things that you don't have the resources to create yourself, which is I again like to like the ducklings thing, like kind of like I feel like what it should be used for, like mood boards where you just want like a blob floating in a desert, but where are you going to get a blob bird?
It's a great like starting point. Yeah, but I also something I loved about that is they get from the perspective of the tractor driver, and he keeps saying like, well, I gotta feed my family too. I got ran off my farm and it's $3 a day, and like I can't turn away $3 a day. And I looked it up, $3 is about $50 today, which is like does not sound like a lot, but like a dinner for a family. It is like how do you succeed in a system where like all the answers are bad, where your own survival means the failure of someone else.
Right. And it's, you know, like the most straightforward answer is to just look out for your family. Like that guy was saying, like, you know, like my kids need food. Like at the end of the day, like practicing solidarity is the long route to security. And he needs it now, which I think is such like, you know, it shows like how easy that trap is to fall into. Like this
Absolutely.
idea of like every man for himself.
Yeah. And one of the messages that I found so heartening throughout it is we have to stick together, basically. Like, there's a line when Ma is in the store that I think is like a company store, and she says, like, when you are in need, when you are in the dark times, turn to the poor because they are the people who will share and who will invite you in. We see that with the Wainwrights at the end. And I think there are very few moments where they turn on that. There's, I think, a moment where they're trying to leave and they're like pushing people off of their truck to try to leave. I'm not sure if it was a camp or something, but I love that we had this in school. I'm upset that I didn't get it because there's such good stuff in here.
Yeah, but I'm also like now like kind of seeing how subliminally it still like impacted us. I'm like, of course I'm the way that I am now. Like I started off being Steinbeck. Like what
Exactly. It's
the fuck?
like it's that and my mom, like having a mom that was a Soviet historian. Of course I'm this way. Of course I'm this way.
Like, how could I be any other way?
Exactly. I love having a physical book. It's not just that it's a great book in terms of the subjects that it touches on. It's also just like word to word, page to page, great. There's in the introduction, Tom is hitches a ride with some guy to his family's farm. And there's this moment where he tells the driver, like, I just got out of prison. The driver sort of gets a little worried because he doesn't know what he was in prison for. And Tom smashes a grasshopper, like on the dashboard or something. And it's menacing. It turns your blood cold. It's like 100 pages later, but when you're getting introduced to the rest of the Joads, the descriptions are positively piercing. Like Winfield was still a trifle of a snot nose, a little of a brooder back of the barn, an inveterate collector and smoker of snipes.
The grasshopper, like when he describes like crushing the skull of the grasshopper, I was like, oh, that like skeletal, like you're literally like he's like murder, homicide.
And that is what he was in jail for. And like
Yeah.
you said, immediately it's like it was self-defense, and that the law doesn't distinguish it, you know? Like the taint of being in prison does not differ based on what you were there for.
Yeah, his whole air, like from like the clothing on his body, or immediately like that stigma is there. And also, I think in the very beginning of the book, when they first introduce Tom and like they describe his like face, I think it starts off with him being described kind of unsympathetically. You know, like you don't really know what this guy's about. It's kind of like interesting to kind of introduce your protagonist in that way, and then like very quickly, like he becomes so beloved. But like for that first few months, like.
You're with the truck driver. You're just as suspicious. You're sort of like, oh, is this our villain? Is this our antagonist? The villain is capitalism.
Yeah.
The end.
The
But
villain is
the next
the bank, the system, the men.
they reference a couple times Pretty Boy Floyd, who I had to look up. Ma knew his mom. He was sort of a Bonnie and Clyde. He was a bank robber in the 30s. And he first went to jail for stealing $3 from a bank, again, like $50, and got paroled out after 3 years. It was a shortened sentence on good behavior. And I think it's the same thing with Tom of like, he crosses state lines, he breaks parole because you cannot live anymore here. There is no way to physically live. There's no way to get food. There's no place to stay. So it's that thing of like, there is no way. I'm writing this script right now that's about religion and womanhood, and that there is no correct way to be a woman, in that no matter how you exist as a woman, it is going to be wrong. And I think that's so similar here.
Yeah, and like the act of like leaving the state is like another act of self-defense. It's another act of self-defense. Like, what is he gonna do? Like, sit there and wait for like the tractor to come hit him? Like, wait for that guy to get $3 from like running him over? Like,
That's such a good way to put it. And there is a character like that who says, like, I just can't leave. And they're like, so you're just gonna walk until you lose your legs? Like, that's all there is.
Yeah, and he's like, I don't know. He's like, I just can't go. Like, but that it's also like, it's also so interesting that they like weave all these characters with such like a strong sense of place. That was something that I really fixated on since like I just got back from China. So it's something that I think about a lot, like what happens to you when you're like displaced. Edward Said writes a lot about it. I used to read a lot of Edward Said. More so, I suppose, also now, but I don't know if we could get into that.
Sure.
But
Anything you want, dive
okay,
in.
there's a, I think it was in Orientalism or one of Edward Said's books where he talks about how like displacement like affects the body and how like when you look at displaced people, like their posture is different. Like they try to recreate their homes in like their new context with whatever materials are around. And A discussion that I'd had in college about this was that, like, you know, like when you go into immigrant houses or people who've like moved from like a very different place, like their furnishings, like the way that they live, feel so out of place and so feel so kind of like gaudy and constructed sometimes. And that's just kind of like that sort of element of like displacement. You can kind of like see that in like every single person on the way to California, every single person it like in the camps in California, like how it's kind of like affected their demeanor. There's like that one quote where it's like, how can we live without our lives? How will we know it's us without our past?
I
And I think
know
I had
that
highlighted that.
too.
I had also highlighted it the first few times that we had read it. But now I'm kind of like, yeah, like when you have to discard everything that you have, like when, you know, circumstances out of your control like force you away from your home, what do you tell the people who are too young to remember things? Like, what do you tell Winfield and Ruthie when they're like adults and they can't actually remember that much about actually having like a home and being treated with dignity? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. At the most, I think Ruthie is maybe 12. I don't think they explicitly say, but yeah, that's such a wonderful point. I think I, in my mind, paired that quote of how do you remember yourself with, there's a quote from Ma who, what a baller, love her, of something like, we're the people who survive. Like we persist because we have to. Which is just so devastating. And yet, like, I can't think of the exact word, but ever present. It's so universal. It's happening to every single person who's also on this journey.
Every single thing, like they start off the like beginning of their journey with like grandpa dying, with like their dog getting run over, the viscera
I
of
forgot about
that. And
him,
then
yeah.
just like, no, literally, like when I read that, I was like, oh my fucking god. And like just like viscera of like that event. And then immediately they're like, we gotta go pack it in. Like, don't look at it, don't look at it, we gotta move. And like grandma then also dies, and like Ma's just like, she's sick, and then just like doesn't say anything and is like next to her for like a whole day.
That part is devastating that grandma dies. They are like in a checkpoint crossing into maybe Texas, maybe into California. Yeah, it was into California because grandma did not live to California. And Ma just says, like, don't look at her, she's sick. We've got someone unwell. And it turns out that Ma is sleeping next to either her mother or her mother-in-law, her dead mother or mother-in-law, for hours just to get them through. And a detail that stuck with me so much is they talk about how much money they have. I think they start with like $140, $180. And there's a line where it's like Pa spent $5 for some wood and some paint so that grandma would have a grave marker. And for some reason, that is a detail that has not when we read it before, but that this reading, I can't stop thinking about because that's a lot of money. Just so that your mom isn't forgotten. And then at the end, when the baby is stillborn, John, who's a fascinating character, just puts him out into the flood and says, like, you don't have a name, and it's your job to tell people that you didn't have a chance and that this is it.
Yeah, and it's like the part where they bury grandma is like so like where they go and get like the grave marker is so like also like heart-wrenching just because they weren't able to bury grandpa with that dignity at all. And
With
like
grandpa,
having
they
them be
didn't.
separated, yeah, also is so like wrenching. Neither of them make it to California. Like they're not able to exist to us in this text, like divorced of that context that they came from.
Yeah, it's that they can't survive without that land. And there's a repeated phrase of like, great grandpa killed the Indians and grandpa made the farms grow. And now they're having to be taken, which of course doesn't talk about the only touches on the colonialism and the.
It's really interesting because like also Steinbeck, like when they enter into California, I think there's a one of those in between chapters where he's talking about how like landowners or like the big like capitalists like, just get like cheaper and cheaper, like immigrants, like Chinese people, Mexican people, like whatever, like they just get them to like work for super cheap and like treat them horribly. And it's interesting who he treats with dignity and who he doesn't treat with dignity. Because like when he's talking about like Native Americans,
There's none.
where's that same energy?
There's none.
You know, John, come on, bring it.
Absolutely.
And it's, yeah, it's like interesting who he finds like solidarity with. And it's also kind of doubly ironic because then he's like talking about how like these Californians are like, oh, Okies aren't people. Like they don't have living standards. Like they would just drive across the country in that ratty old car, like whatever. And you know, like the text is very clearly like these people are like treating like humans like trash, but then, you know, there are moments where, you know, his own narrative is aged.
Yeah, exactly. And it's you know, there were phrases in which the Californians talked about the Okies, about the Joads, that came straight out of, or not, you know, in a 21st century context, come straight out of like Donald Trump's 2016 campaign, about their murderers and things like that. But it's also, like you were saying, it's like they have these foul living conditions. Can you imagine they live like this? And it's like, yeah, because those conditions have been imposed upon them by you. You know, you're judging them for these circumstances that didn't exist a couple months ago.
Right. Like they didn't have to like leave their land. Like they would have tried to like continue to make it work. The banks were the actual like catalyst for the leaving and for the everyone having zero money, like no prospects, the overcrowding of like migrant workers, recruiting for like 3,000 workers, but like getting like 6,000 and then just like having what they're going to pay everyone. Like those are not just like isolated things.
Yeah, it's, I think, chapter 14 that rocked my world. It's one of the interstitial, is that the word? Chapters, and it's all about, well, there's another section that I don't know if I have right off the top of my head, but about people in California are this, you know, not aggressive, but agitated and vile towards the Okies and the people moving because they are scared, because resources are limited and they don't want to lose the little that they already have. Which, at least, you know, I have family from the South, and I think that's where a lot of, rooted in racism, there's a lot of things of like white people who are extremely poor who are like, well, at least I'm not them. And at least, you know, I don't have anything, but at least the people of other races have even less than me, because it's all about rank and status and hierarchy. But in chapter 14, the continued refrain is things are results, not causes. That all of these things are results of hunger, of lack. It's just a beautiful 4 pages, and it's the, I only have a few lines highlighted, but this one was gorgeous. Fear the time when man's self will not suffer and die for a concept. For this one quality is the foundation of man's self, and this one quality is man, distinctive in the universe.
There's another line in that same chapter. I think it's in a like a really long passage. I am reading this on Kindle, so you know you can see where everybody has highlighted. And it's all interesting to see like places where like everyone is highlighting. And I'm also kind of like thinking about the state of the country. I'm like, did you really highlight this like a little bit? Because then one of the things that I highlighted that was also very commonly kind of noted was the line like, for the quality of owning freezes you forever into quote unquote I and cuts you off forever from the concept of me, which it's also like, you know, like again to your point, like people being like, oh, I don't have anything, but at least I have more than X, Y, and Z, like this fixation on like what property you have. Like what kind of like rank or like whatever you can accrue.
Need is the stimulus to concept to action. 500,000 people moving over the country, 1 million more restive, ready to move, 10 million more feeling the first nervousness. And that also talks about, if this tractor were ours, it would be good, not mine, but ours. If our tractor turned the long furrows of our land, it would be good. Things like that, which I think, like, it's a brutal read in parts because it's 85 years old and it feels like, you know, we are still dealing with these exact issues. And yet that refrain is, I mean, you have to take hope in it. And there are characters like Ma who just refuse to stop, who refuse to let it break them, stop them, and who refuse to surrender their humanity in order to survive.
Or like change the way that they interact with or are in community with others. Because like no matter how hard it gets, like you know, again, like you go to people who are poor and struggling and they will share with you. She is always kind of like, you know, like when she's like cooking and all those little kids are like around, and she's like, I can't give you all of it, but here's a little. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. And then a mom of those kids comes up and says, "Don't do that because now my kid wants food all the time and I don't have it."
And she's like, wouldn't you do that too? Like, a
Yeah.
bunch of kids are sitting there looking at you. Wouldn't you help them too? She just has to go away.
Yeah. I really want to talk about that government camp because that truly ends up being sort of the promised land, not in the way that we expected it to be, but that is the way that we take care of each other, where cops don't do any good, where they say, like, no one is allowed to take charity because that sort of makes a burn that doesn't come out. They made us crawl for our dinner. They took our dignity. We don't allow nobody to give nothing to another person. They can give it to the camp, and the camp can pass it out. We won't have no charity.
It's so kind of like clear that, like I think what a lot of people think of in terms of like charity as it's used like conversationally today is kind of like you're like helping other people. It feels like people who do have not actually had to like interact with the power structure of charity, like do not understand the burn that they're saying it leaves. That camp really highlights like the difference between like being in community with others, giving aid, receiving aid, whatever, and like the difference between all of that from charity. 'Cause then like charity is like a place that like you have to like prostrate yourself to. Like there's that inherent sort of like power abuse.
Yeah, you have to prove that you are deserving of receiving it.
And it's so conditional, right? Like
Yeah, anyway.
that actually just reminded me, one of my high school teachers at the second high school that I went to in senior year, she came to school dressed as the Grapes of Wrath 1 year for Halloween. So she literally just like balloons, like with like angry faces all over her body. It was pretty incredible.
Yeah, I wanted to pull that quote out. I know I highlighted it and I'll find it eventually. But if I remember it correctly, it's like it's grapes being wrathful because they're not being used, because they're not going to be profitable. They're left to wither on the vine. There's also, I love finding used books because you can see what other people highlight. There's a wonderful scene where Ma goes to the company store and is trying to barter with this man, and he ends up giving her some charity in the end. But there's just a wonderful line where the store owner goes, "A fella got a right to eat," and Ma says, "What fella?"
Kind of going back to chapter 15, there's one part where they're talking. It's like the paragraph that's like beside them, little pot-bellied men in light suits and Panama hats, like talking about like them like being worried because like their business isn't like working out, their formulas aren't working out. Like I want security, but like where's it going? And then it's like talking about how they have to like reassure themselves that business is noble and not the curious ritualized thievery they know it is. And that didn't hit me the first few times I read that, but like now as like a working
Ooh.
man, ritualized thievery. I hope my bosses aren't listening. It does remind me of like right after my first job when like I'd had truly kind of an awful time because you come out of college and you have a lot of hope. You have a lot of hope. You have a lot of I won't say that principles like go away, but they certainly do kind of like become more informed, is how I'll say it. But like kind of going into like this first job, I had like this such like a strong like this is my ethical line, this is my whatever, this is what I will not do. And then kind of coming out of that job being like, oh, like morals and ethics are not like in the workplace, they're two very separate things. Like what is ethical in a workplace? A lot of times, not moral, not something you should do. Business,
Yeah.
selling my little computer rectangles to you for money, curious ritualized thievery.
Yeah.
and you really construct all these rituals around it. Like at
Exactly.
least.
The line is, they are kind and charitable in spite of the principles of sound business, that their lives are rich instead of the thin, tiresome routines they know, and that a time is coming when they will not be afraid anymore.
It's like that's it. Like charitable in spite of the principles of sound business. Like you say like, oh, we've worked with a nonprofit. We've worked blah blah blah. Like we are socially minded. Like at the end of the day, like you see this all the time in like big companies. They're like, oh, we overhired. Instead of redistributing wealth or whatever, we're just gonna axe a bunch of people. I had a friend who moved to New York during the pandemic, and he was working as a web product designer at this really small studio. And when the pandemic hit, they laid him off. And then 2 months later, they posted on Instagram, they were like, we want to make sure all our employees are taken care of during the pandemic. So we paid for all of us to take a retreat upstate, masked and distanced. And he was like, with that money, you could have kept the five of us that you laid off employed, for at least a little bit. How is that charitable? How is that caring for other people? I don't know. A time is coming when they will not be afraid anymore. When will we not be at the whims of the economy?
I was watching Succession last night, and it's the episode where their father dies, and half of the conversation is, good Lord, our dad, who we have this complicated relationship, just died, and also, how is this going to affect the stock price?
There's no room for being like a person when it comes to money.
Even like I worked at an agency, a very, very small agency for a hot second when I first moved to LA, and that was really tough, just hearing about how people are reduced to types, to the ways that agents sometimes refer to certain people and their types. There was like a week or so, especially like for certain commercials for certain brands, like athletic and athleisure things, for photo shoots where it's like requiring a certain BMI. So it suddenly becomes my job to calculate everyone's BMI. And that's not even like trying necessarily to sell something, but it also is. It's also, I mean, that's become a whole thing in becoming an actor of like, I really got to clean up this acne because I don't know if it's gonna get in the way of me getting a job or not.
There's so many small things that feel like indignities, but then are so symptomatic of a larger all of these fucking issues. Not only is the system, the bank, the companies, whatever, not only do they drive people off the land, but also they police bodies. They create this weird world where morals and caring for other people isn't something you should do because it's not profitable.
And not only do we like see the physical weathering of the individual bodies of Rose of Sharon has a miscarriage or gives birth to a stillborn baby. I mean, we lose so many members of this family over time. Like, I forgot that there was another brother. There's Noah. There's Jim Casey, who's such a wonderful character. I know Noah, who like fully disappears for chapters and then again just walks off.
He's like, you guys didn't like me that much anyway. You won't miss me that much.
And he's
And
described as like simple and different, and I feel like he fully knows his place in that family.
no, definitely. And Jim Casey, the longer that I sit and think about his character, the more that I'm damn, I want to be that kind of principled. That man's like, listen, what I can do for you, I'm going to do. I hit the cop. When he's like, yes, I hit the cop. And I'm like, that's the worst cover I've ever heard.
I know, and he's the one who was willing to give up everything for everyone, and he dies, and his relationship with Tom is really fascinating, and that at the end, one of the last scenes we get with Tom, it's him sort of saying, like, I'm taking on his mantle, and there's this just gorgeous sequence where I think seeing it, like, out of context becomes a little corny, but he's like, wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there, and whenever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there. I'll be in the way kids laugh when they're hungry and they know supper's ready. I think when I read it the first time, I think Uncle John was my favorite because he clearly is dealing with some mental health issues, and I was craving any representation possible. But I think it was like Uncle John is suffering inside. That's me.
Me too. I also am taking my $2 to the bar.
And I loved his character so much, and I loved how they talked about sin. And Casey says, I can't find it right now, but says like it's a sin if you think it's wrong. Or no, it's
You
a
build
sin if
your
it's
own
something you're
sin.
not sure about. Oh, here it is. If you think it was a sin, then it's a sin. A fella builds his own sins right up from the ground, like you said.
Yeah, that whole passage where Tom takes up that mantle, it very much is like, like in the beginning, like Jim Casey's like, I want to be where the people are. I want to be where
I want to
the
hear where the people are.
people are.
I want to see
This
him
turns into a
dancing.
little mermaid.
He is my little mermaid.
He was in that irrigation ditch
That
baptizing.
harsh. This is a tangent. Have you seen that little tiny boy on TikTok who is a pastor? Who was on the Jennifer Hudson
What?
talk show? Yeah, there's a little boy. I first saw him just a video of this little boy in like a huge robe, and his mom is like, "What are you doing?" And he goes, "I'm gonna baptize all my stuffed animals. Bye." And then he's in the tub in this giant robe, like baptizing like Bluey and the Paw Patrol. And he gets on the Jennifer Hudson talk show, and he is in a little suit. He is singing. He is dancing. He has the spirit in him. He's hooting and hollering. I'll find it to you. I think his name is Pastor Luke.
Wow. This, I feel like they should ordain him right now in Universal Life because they'll send him a little badge that says clergy on it.
It.
Wait, I actually, no, I have that badge somewhere in this home. I got ordained like 2 years and it's gold leafed. Pastor Luke deserves it. I think his mom should look into it.
And here I'm looking at a quote of, "Where does the terrible faith come from? Where does the courage come from?" Chapter 7 is amazing because I think when I read it in high school, it gave me such a, it has such a rhythm and a pace to it. It starts in the towns, on the edges of the towns, in the fields and the vacant lots, the used car yards, the wrecker yards, the garages with blazing signs. I think it just taught me a lot about dialogue, about rhythm, about how prose can be inventive and communicative. It gives you an anxiety, a rush, like reading it out loud makes your breath behave a certain way. That
Yeah.
alone is just some good writing.
I think like presenting it in like prose format makes it feel kind of very like auction blocky. You
Exactly.
know what I
That's
mean? Like
exactly it.
it creates that pace, that frenzy of like, I just need these cars out of here.
It's so startling, I think, to put. I think when you're looking at the Okies and the people who are still farming in 39, it feels so distant from the rest of the world it exists in. Like, I was looking at things that happened in 39. Wizard of Oz comes out, turns 85 this year. Batman also makes his debut. Like, this is the same year as Batman. It feels like those things can't exist in the same world, and yet they do.
Right.
Yeah, Batman comes into the world the same year that Germany invades Poland.
It's so hard to relate those two things. It's kind of like, like I was happy today. However, all of these other things have happened. Like while Batman's like patrolling Gotham or whatever, like they're burying Grandpa Joan on the side of the road.
And you know how fucking crazy Winfield would go to get Batman right now? Yeah, there's
If he
Ruthie holding.
knew, if he
If
could
he
know.
knew, Ruthie gone apeshit over a Cracker Jack box, and risking Tom's life, and no one can fault her for it, which I love. Like, I loved that scene of like Pa gets
Yeah.
really upset, and Ma's like, she's beat herself up enough for all of us.
Yeah. And like, she's a child in a terrible situation. Like,
Yeah.
in what world would she be? Like, in what world should she have to like be forced to like live without dignity and like in fear that like her family is going to be ripped away from her? Like,
Yeah. And obviously time's very different. When I moved from Maryland to California, that took 5 days to drive, driving about 12 hours each day, and I did stop in Ada, Oklahoma. And I don't know how long this took them, but they were suddenly in California, I think earlier than I expected. So in a fairly brief time, Ruthie has lost her grandmother, her grandfather, her dog, her brother, her brother-in-law, Connie. What a
right.
toe of Connie.
I think in high school, I thought it was like such a flex to like sympathize with Connie. And now I'm like, this man's like, I'm gonna go back to school. I'm like, I say that every year.
I'm gonna learn to make a radio. Yeah. And there was a detail about when they get to whatever, I don't think it's the government camp, but they get to California for the first time. Maybe it's the government camp, and Ma is like, we all need to wash up, we need to make a really good impression. And Rosa Sharn puts on her wedding shoes. It broke me. It broke me. They have like little bows on
Oh my
them.
God. Also, the switch between like, when they're on the road and they're like, they're not there yet. They haven't seen like what California is for the migrant worker. And like Honey and like Rosa Sharn are just like over there, like flirting, like
I
trying to have
know.
sex, like trying to have sex in a truck. And then like the set, his attitude turns very quickly. And
Yeah.
he's like, I'm gonna stay at home,
Should have stayed
like when
home.
things don't happen immediately. And then literally, like, I don't know what the timeline is,
Yeah.
but like they are not in California for very long before he's just like, I'm going, like going on a walk, yeah, or whatever, like doesn't come back.
I think you're right. I think he just literally pieces out, goes to buy cigarettes, and never comes home, you know?
Literally.
Man, I want to find that. What is that single turning point? What is that single moment that makes Connie sort of like back out?
But it's also like in the beginning where they talk about how like Rosa Sharn, like after she gets pregnant, she like changes, her demeanor changes, and he's just kind of like, oh, I thought we were just fooling around. He's like, I don't know what to do with this. And so he just like pretends to be kind of like, yeah, I get it the whole time. And it's like, I guess like if he's like pretending to get it, like he's 18 years old, but he's clearly like so immature. He doesn't know what the fuck is like required to have a family.
Yeah, I mean, as any 18-year-old,
Yeah.
and I'm such a sucker for Al and Aggie getting engaged at the end, especially because the baby, I think the whole time, and I didn't really realize it, I think I was projecting it like onto the family members, and it wasn't actually in the text. I was having this so much of like, but Rosa Sharn is gonna have this baby, and there's gonna be this life, and the family's gonna continue and expand and grow, and there's hope for the future, and there's like a rainbow, and then the baby is dead, you know?
Rereading it and knowing that while she's agonizing over like every single thing, like in the government camp, like when that like old lady is like,
Oh my God, yeah.
don't dance, you're gonna kill your baby. And she's immediately like, oh my God. And she's so concerned. And then just like that outcome, like knowing, was so terrible.
Oh God, I didn't even think about. And I had forgotten that the baby is stillborn. And in my head, maybe I already said this, in my head, you know, I had that final image. We talk in screenwriting about, you know, first and last images. That final image with her breastfeeding the man, I really thought that man was Tom. And so in the final pages, I was like, when's Tom coming back? When and he didn't. And Tom is like our protagonist, more or less. You know, it's really the family, and he's not there for the last like 30 pages or so, and he's living in a culvert with his face all smashed in the dark.
That man really, like, I forgot that he moved into like a cave, just sitting in there waiting for his nose to not be broken.
The relationship between him and Jim Casey is really fascinating to me, and that he sees him just killed right in front of him.
Yeah. And then I think afterwards, is he like talking to Ma or something where he's like, he just didn't duck fast enough.
Exactly. He just didn't duck fast enough.
That was crazy. Like this time around, I have forgotten what Al was like. And I like him so much.
Yeah. He's just a
It, like,
kid. Yeah.
and he's trying so hard to be like a grown up. He's like, like the way that, when he enters and he like kind of like sizes up his brother to see like what his attitude is. And then he immediately is like, okay, he doesn't have like that swagger about him. Like, I'm gonna wrap it up. Like,
Yeah, I don't remember the exact line, and maybe it was just like the impression that I got, but it is like he idolizes Tom so much. There's in the pages where they first depart, they talk about like how nervous Al is, and he's like, the whole family is resting on my ability to drive because I'm the only person who can drive besides Tom, and how anxious,
yeah.
and he's got to be 18, maybe 16 even. He's a little guy, and he's just horny. He just wants to go and flirt and go to dances and be a kid.
Yeah, and he doesn't get to, and like when that part like breaks really early in their journey and he's like, I didn't do it. Like, I didn't do it. Like, I'm sorry. I didn't like I couldn't have anticipated this.
Yeah.
And it's like so sad, but like over the course of the novel, you really see that like go away, and he's like, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna do that. And he starts like really kind of like coming, again into his own. And I'm also just kind of reminded of like in the beginning where he's like, did you like break out of jail, and Tom is like, no, I got the role. And he's, damn it, like, we've been so fucking cool. Damn
Exactly. I love that
it.
Tom comes home and everyone is like, you didn't break out, right? 'Cause you might did are you here
Like, I
legally?
wouldn't put it past you.
Exactly. They're like, we are all so happy to see you, but we need to know.
Yeah. And then, okay, also, like, I think it was like in the government camp right before they leave, when Tom is like, I would love to be like Al. I'm still like that. I'm still young. I'm still like trying to go after girls. And Ma's like, shut the fuck up. Like, no,
Yeah.
you're not. I got you. You need. You're not like me. You're not like that. You cannot be like that.
You just like we just can't
And
have that.
yeah, and also like while I was like I kind of double timed this where like I was reading it and then also supplementing it while I was on the train by like listening to it.
Yeah.
Which also I hate when audiobooks like when the narrator like tries to put on like a voice because like they were doing some sort of I was like, is that British for like
Oh,
Ma? I was like,
no.
that's but like when she was saying it, I was like, it's also so interesting to see like the parents' like vulnerabilities and like how like you know at first they're talking about how like Ma is like you know like so strong like how Pa like doesn't take shit from people and then like you know in the end you can see how like you know like Pa just like doesn't want to talk about like what he's nervous about. Ma is also just kind of like relying on she's like okay no, like Tom you need to be present also like I need you to help me like maintain this.
Yeah, I don't know the exact moment, but I was thinking about it a lot. There's an early part where Tom says, like, in prison, you cannot spend your whole time thinking about when you're gonna get out in 5 years. You have to start thinking, you always have to be like, Saturday, we're gonna have like a movie. And you have to keep the, you know, those short-term things in mind. And I think by the end, and I think Ma echoes that statement in that moment, but by the end, Ma is so focused on like, we just have to do the next thing and we just have to get to the next thing and is so focused on the immediate and Ma, I love Ma. I love Ma so much. My heart breaks for her. She is trying so hard. I hate is too strong of a word for Pa because he's just so inconsequential. He's just there. And the whole time he's like, my woman's telling me what to do. What do I do?
Like, I can't believe women telling men I should go get a
Exactly.
stick.
It's like, Pa, you have done nothing. Pa, you have done nothing.
You don't even
Yeah, what are you bringing to this table besides complaints?
the fuck up? Like, no, and like literally, and also like there are moments where like Ma, you know, like right before they leave for California, this is one moment, and she's like, oh, do you really think like California is like that? You know, it like looks so beautiful. She's like so like hopeful. She's like really like there are all these like moments where like you know like when I was home in China, like I kind of saw this in my grandma too. I was like, oh, like you're just a girl. She still has those moments where she's like, oh, like this is my fantasy. Like oh, like when I go somewhere, like we're gonna have like a house, right? It's gonna be a little white house.
I think that's a broader thing in the podcast that I've learned is that we always have that child inside of us, you know? But I think that's also such a huge, like, I wouldn't classify this as a coming of age novel really at all, but I think that is such a critical moment in becoming an adult is realizing your parents are people too.
And also, like when you're younger, like if you learn that your parents are people, it is much harder to be empathetic with it. You know what I mean? You're just like, God fucking damn it. And I think, like, the older we get, the more I'm kind of like, able to create space for both, like the fact that they are people and have had disservices happen to them and like still are like their own like children, like inside of them, but then also like me and then all the
Yeah, that they can exist both
things.
as people and as parents, and that sometimes those things are by necessity separate.
Yeah. Also, that just reminded me of in the very, very beginning where he's talking about the card that his grandma sent him in jail, and she just picked it because it was pretty.
Yeah.
It was like blessed child or something like that.
Yeah, I had those cards from my grandparents. Yep. With a crisp $20 bill inside. Absolutely.
Except our grandparents knew what it said.
That's true. Yeah, all I can think is like, because what else did they have to do over there in Paducah, Kentucky? We had a big hour-long gossip catch-up about the people who we went to high school with that are now married.
And now we're back.
And now we're back. We talked about how the thing that got us back is that, like many women, Ma is raising her husband.
And she at least won't put up with it. But she do be out here like explaining to her son that like you need to make fun of your man to get him to go.
She really is the MVP, and I wish her all the best. I hope she gets a little house. The end is, I mean, it's hopeful in the bleakest way possible.
Yeah. It's like scorched earth hopeful. Like plants are now growing in Chernobyl again.
We both turned red. And on that note, how do you feel having read this as an adult?
I feel really reaffirmed in that I love John Steinbeck. Right at the beginning of college, I read East of Eden. Also, people made fun of me for reading because I went to art school, as did you.
Crazy place. Yeah. My art school was like, we don't say this out loud because it sounds like bad, but we're a trade school. We're gonna get you a job. Was yours like that?
I think parts of the school were, and then my major was like, graphic design is the same thing as sociology and philosophy, and you are an intellectual. And instead of teaching you skills, we're going to pivot into theory.
Yeah, we didn't do much of that, which I was thankful for.
I just think that the balance could have been a little bit better. I think I escaped relatively unscathed, but I do know that some people the few years after me were like, I don't know how to space typography. And I'm like, that seems like something you should
That's
know.
bad. That seems pretty beginner.
Yeah, I'm like, that seems like something somebody should have told you about
Yeah.
before you tried to get a job.
Yeah. But East of Eden, I cut you off.
East of Eden, I am really glad I reread this. I also have been kind of in a reading drought, so this really picked it back up. But I'm like
Yay.
now wanting to like read more of like his other novels. I will never read Of Mice and Men again. That was
No.
traumatizing.
I will only read it again if someone asks to for this podcast. And it is short, but no, not
Yeah,
interested.
just upsetting. I
Yeah.
was on a cruise ship when I read them.
I found The Pearl in a little free library, and that's similarly tiny. Maybe I'll do that someday. I don't know.
I don't know if anyone's wanted to do Ernest Hemingway.
Not yet, but that would be
Like,
great.
I actually am realizing the older I get that I absolutely fucking hate Ernest.
He's a bad man. I mean, I think. I started watching the Ken Burns series on him and then I fell asleep because I love Ken Burns for that. I also just love Ken Burns.
Yeah, I remember learning about the Ken Burns effect.
It
Great
was
time.
it's like a single button on iMovie, but we had a whole project about
Great time in sixth grade when they were like,
Yes.
have you ever heard of documentary filmmaking? And I was like,
We talked a little bit about this off mic. We had a whole unit about illuminated manuscripts where they just said for a week you're gonna have to use calligraphy pens and be silent in this class, and it was very smart of them. And the only we had that was actually such a sick class. We made a full televised game show, which started me down the path I am on now, and that
we
was this
literally had to use like soundboards.
yeah
Crazy.
and like channel mixers. It was We had a very well-designed set in terms of production design, and something I remember because it was very validating and flattering. At the end of that year, we had to make like Greek theater masks. And I remember
Yes.
we had a great teacher, and she was looking around the classroom. She was like going over everything before we started painting. She was like, nobody actually has pink lips, except Aaron. And then just kept talking. And I hold that in my heart every day. Thank you, Lisa Robusky.
Love Lisa. I talk about our eighth grade trip to New York a lot, and people are really confused at how or why or what we were doing. And in retrospect, I also kind of am.
I don't know how they expected eighth graders to really do that project, but my dad had an
We
in.
did it,
We did it. We did
but
a really
also
good
we did it.
one. We did a really good
I
one.
was terrible on B-roll, but terrible on
We
B-roll,
were
as
also
I
eighth
recall.
graders. We were also
Yeah,
eighth
but
graders.
do you remember when we had like that chaperone who was like kind of
Oh, she's
crazy
just,
and she like
yes.
made us walk? Like, I think about this every time I'm in Soho because I'm like, that's the McDonald's that we had to go pee in. I didn't know what train it was off, but as it turns out, it was the six. And I think about when she dragged us across Soho to go visit her friend who was like a fucking cop. And we got all those t-shirts
Oh
that said like
yeah.
Red Rum on it.
We went to the NYPD or something like that. Yeah. I guess I either forgot that or I thought that was like part of like everyone had to do that part of a trip. Damn. That was just us.
And then she like, I feel like right afterwards, like made us sit in a Nine West with her while she was like trying on boots.
I think she took
I
us to
recall it.
Chinatown, so or Canal Street.
So that we could learn to haggle in
Yeah.
retrospect and issue. Crazy time.
Final question. Would you consider this required reading?
Yes.
Yeah,
Yes.
me too. Absolutely. At least, like, for the very minimum, a phenomenal book to read alongside, like, learning about the Great Depression, and also just a phenomenal book. Like, I was trying to think, like, is there another great American novel that covers all of it in the way that this does? And I can't think of one.
And also, like, really incredible to read it as an adult, but also, like, great to have absorbed those concepts as, like, a young person. Like, the idea of, like, unionizing, of, like, the power of labor, the crazy relationship that America has to labor.
I think it's just one of those books where, like, you can, if you wanted to treat it like a sacred text, you could, and just open it to any page and be like, what wisdom does this page have for me? Because it would.
Yeah. There's no other author that I can think of who so beautifully captures like the really lovely things about America, but also shows like very strongly all the ways in which America fails. Yeah.
I'm so glad to reread it because I really got none of it. Where was
I
I?
know.
Where was I?
I'm like, damn. One of my old coworkers literally unionized one of her previous workplaces and then
Hell
like dipped right afterwards. And I'm like,
Just
John would be
like
proud.
John Casey. Yeah, he dipped out of life.
Oh.
And on that, is there anything you'd like to plug as we round out where people can find you if you want to be found?
I am a graphic designer, as we have mentioned before. I work at Team Design, located in Dumbo, Brooklyn. We love working with cultural organizations. Branding's super fun. I don't really have anything. Oh, I'm knitting my second sweater ever. That will be coming soon at some point and may be documented on the internet.
Thank you so much for coming. This has been so great.
Oh, thank you for having me. Oh my God, this is so fun.
Thank you so much to Wa. If you have never read Grapes of Wrath, or if you haven't read Grapes of Wrath in, a decade, revisit it. It's really a good read and worth reading. Don't be overwhelmed by how thick it is. 'Cause it does kind of move at a really good clop. All right, this is the third time I've tried recording this. I don't know why I have worms in my brain right now. They haven't been here up until today. It's 2:25 p.m. on April 1st. Our next episode is Dragonology. Did the hair on the back of your neck just stand up? I know it did. Well, what? I'm Erin Bowles. Thank you so much for listening. You can find me everywhere at Erin R. Bowles. The R stands for recompense. I don't know. Actually, what does that mean? Let's give it a quick Goog. It's sometimes you're like, you think you know what words mean, but then it's always good to say, actually, do I? Do I know? Like, infamous means famous for bad reasons. It's not just like extra notable. I once had to learn that in front of my 12th grade English teacher, and I did blush. It was not comfy. Recompense. Make amends to someone for loss or harm suffered. Compensate. Emotional damages. All right. Good night. Love you. Thanks for being here. Dragonology next week. Bye.